Hi everybody, welcome back to the Flicks the Church Forgot. Tune in to the previous episodes in this little mini-series. If you want to hear reviews of four classic Frankenstein movies, Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein from Universal in the 30s, Curse of Frankenstein from Hammer, a little review of Reanimator from the 1980s, and also, Frankenstein the True Story, the 1970s mini-series. But for now, we're going to look a bit longer and harder into the creature's eyes and discover the ideology and ideas that have made this story resonate with us for so many, many years. First up, we'll explore the early Christian objections to the whale film as challenging the idea of a creator. Then we'll discuss theories that the story is really just a metaphor representing homosexual identity. And finally, I'll present my own theory for what I think the story means, or at least what it means to me. The novel Frankenstein has never been out of print since it was first published in 1818, which is a pretty startling fact when you think about it. And after 5 years, it was adapted as a stage play presented in the English Opera House in London. And an interesting little tidbit, apparently the play was picketed by Christians at the time who were disgusted with the story, labelling it as impious. Which, if you'd like a funky new word to share at parties, means something that shows an utter lack of respect for religion or God. And let that lead us to the following question. Is the Frankenstein story impious, or is it an affront to God? Does it celebrate or condemn playing God? That certainly seems to have been the issue for many audiences back in the day, both when they read the original novel and when they saw the Universal movies in particular. Though I hardly think there are many people paying to see I, Frankenstein in cinemas today who have an issue with the playing God idea. I don't think people are that bothered about that. Still though, the original audiences to the Universal movies couldn't help but read a religious context into the film because the original Frankenstein contains a prologue stating as such. It was forced on director James Whale by the producer Carl Laemmle, and it wasn't even directed by Whale, and certainly has a different vibe to the rest of the film. And in it, Edward Van Sloan stands on a theatre stage talking to the audience saying, "We are about to unfold the story of Frankenstein, a man of science who sought to create a man after his own image without reckoning on God." So there's a clear stroking of the church here, sort of like, hey everyone, I know this film seems a bit godless and everything, but don't fret, God's there in the background making sure the monster gets all burned up at the end. Phew, we can rest easy with the senses now. It's an interesting addition, but comes across a little clumsy and necessary and does feel at odds with the rest of the picture. But you can see why such an idea was put there, because the filmmakers felt they needed to reinforce Christian social and theological norms. In other words, you know, we are not the creators, we are the creation, and if you mess with that, you'll probably die horribly. However, as a Christian myself, I think the early Christian critics of Frankenstein really sort of missed the point of the book and the film. Baron Frankenstein may well announce that he knows what it's like to be God because he can bring body parts to life, but I'm sorry, but I'm not that impressed. That is clearly an exercise in overstatement. This isn't creation as such. The idea of God is that he created everything out of nothing. Now, that is impressive. Whereas all Frankenstein is doing is simply working out how to restart dead tissue. No mean feat, I admit that, but it's quite a world away from creating something out of nothing. So when Frankenstein in the 1931 James Whale version, when Colin Clive hysterically shouts, it's alive, now I know what it's like to be God, it's not actually that offensive to my faith in the slightest. That line doesn't chill me because I think it's blasphemous. It chills me because it shows this guy's arrogance, that he thinks he has become God by confusing creation with recreation, or rather, reanimation. Those are two very different concepts. The latter is hard. No scientist has cracked bringing the dead back. But the former, real creation out of a vacuum, that's impossible. Both practically and, one could argue, theoretically. Let me explain. You see, every step of Frankenstein's endeavor, as every human endeavor is ultimately reliant on God if God exists. for creating the building blocks for the basics for us to work with. And from this argument, even the atheist who shouts loudly that God doesn't exist is not taking into account that God has given him or her the mouth and speech to which to express that. This is obviously a scenario in which God does exist. In the atheist scenario, there is no God, meaning anyone claiming to be like God is saying something ultimately meaningless. It's like saying, I feel like Santa Claus, or I feel like a social construct. It's interesting, but means little. Therefore, I mean, those Christians who took offense at the film, and might even still do, I just think they're wasting their breath. Frankenstein is comparing himself either with a real or a culturally imagined God, but either way, it's pointless. If God is real, then it's logistically impossible to be equal to the creator because you are forever a created being. And if there is no God, then who cares if you're liking yourself to a religious myth? What's the problem? And besides, the resistance to the scientific vision of Frankenstein actually also feels a bit Luddite and annoying. It typifies a general and growing feeling at the time that while science may be our savior, it might also become our destroyer. Only 20 years later, this theme would dominate science fiction and horror movies in the 1950s with a steady stream of atomically mutated creatures set to destroy the Earth. It comes up again in the ecological horrors of the 70s where pollution causes mutations. Then even in the Japanese horrors of the 90s and new millennium where technology becomes the portal for the demonic and the dead. It's always amusing and fascinating to me when I speak to those of an older generation about the breadth of internet developments and computer and nanotechnology, and they respond with the line, it's frightening. But is this resistance and fear of science and technology really necessary? Well, of course, it can be used for ill, and I'm not suggesting we do away with scientific or medical ethics, but I think we waste our time hiding from progress just because it's new. Yet that seems to be what the characters do in these Frankenstein movies. They say to Frankenstein, you must not create life. It is an affront to God. It is evil. And I tend to listen to them and say, really? Is it? Okay, if the Baron starts killing people for his experiments, then ethically we're in hot water. But just the principle of creating life in a new way, does that denote blasphemy? Because of this reliance, actually, we all have on a creator so that we might create. I'll put it this way. Even a genetically engineered sheep built and grown in a lab may appear to the world to be born outside of the natural system, but in many ways it's not outside of the natural system. It still relies on natural processes and stimulation, and not least, on a created human mind to organize it all. The anti-science rhetoric of the early Frankenstein critics, and frankly, the present-day religious critics of science and progress, would do well to remember the overarching need for God in any scientific scenario, and not act as if scientists are working in a world where they have kicked God out. Some may have consciously done that, but if God is real, they are perhaps unknowingly relying on him as much as anyone else, for the breath in their lungs, for the chemical reactions in their petri dishes, for the fine-tuning of the universe, for the opening of the more mysterious, freaky quantum files of knowledge that are only starting to explore. I guess what I'm saying is science isn't to be feared, because if God does exist, then it can never set itself up in place of God because of its self-reliance on him. If he does, then science becomes a tool that, I guess as Stephen Hawking once wrote in The Brief History of Time, allows us to know the mind of God. On the other hand, of course, the scenario is God doesn't exist, and that is completely possible too. But I think if the minute that you say God does exist, there is an implication there that everything, therefore, must rely on him, because if he is the creator, we are always constantly the creation. Frankenstein coming along and saying he feels like God is a fun and is an interesting thing, but it's not that controversial, because maybe he feels like God, but he could not possibly be God because he is a created being. On to analysis number two, that is the homosexual analysis. Now, as you probably know, The Making of Bride of Frankenstein was used as the backdrop for a really interesting film about James Whale starring Ian McKellen called Gods and Monsters. Actually, it's a film I just watched this evening, in fact. A phrase coined by Dr. Pretorius in the original film, in the 1935 film Bride of Frankenstein, where he says he does a toast to gods and monsters, and that's the name of this film. And this film explores how Whale himself was gay and had some implications in that film that some of the main actors in Bride of Frankenstein were gay too. The writer Gary Morris suggests that in the Bright Lights Film Journal that it was rumoured that both Colin Clive and Ernest Deringer, who played Dr. Pretorius, were either gay or bisexual. Whatever the case with the stars of the film, Whale certainly was gay, and so I guess it's not a surprise that the film Bride of Frankenstein has been more open than most to a thematically homosexual reading. And as I mentioned in my review of Frankenstein the True Story, I think there are homosexual undercurrents to that too, or at least you can read those into it. Now, James Whale's own biographer pointed out that Whale would never have identified the monster in this way, and that there is an inherent sense of offensiveness in that idea when you think about it. And it is pretty offensive, isn't it? The idea that a freak of nature, that'd be a good image for homosexuality. That sets off all sorts of pastoral alarm bells. And yet film scholars have still read a deeper homosexual subtext into the story, not least between Dr. Pretorius and Henry Frankenstein, or even between Frankenstein and the monster himself. Some have even argued that the supposed gay vibe of the film can simply be seen in the very camp nature of Pretorius's character. At one point, the comedy value housemaid in Bride of Frankenstein announces Pretorius' arrival to the Baron, and he says, "A very queer-looking gentleman." Now, some people have cited that as being an example of the homosexual undercurrent, so people assume that means gay, but that seems a bit simplistic to me. And if I was gay myself, I think I'd be a little annoyed that just because a character is camp automatically slots them into the gay label. Despite what Whale's biographer says about the monster not being a symbol for homosexuality, there are plenty of authors to disagree, writers and scholars, and film theorists. Elizabeth Young, for example, talks about the monster as being potentially gay or bisexual. She explains this in the sense that in the film, he doesn't seem to differentiate the idea of friend from mate, i.e., he's got a bride, which implies a romantic sexual connection, and yet he classifies her as friend, along with the blind old hermit who gives him smokes and booze in the hut in one of the film's genuinely touching scenes. Gary Morris goes on to say that more traditionally leaning locals quickly turn up at this hut, and this homosexual liaison, as it were, is broken up between the blind old man and the creature, and they burst in with guns, scaring Karloff away and accidentally burn the hut down. The implied message being, "You two blokes shouldn't be that close, alright? You know, now get back to your bride and ideally stop calling her friend and start calling her darling or something instead." Now, of course, some people might feel that these readings of the homosexual tone into this film are reading a bit too much into it. But it is worth looking at an intriguing moment in the original novel, at chapter 5, that seems to suggest that there were hints of this from the start, even in Shelley's novel. There is this really weird moment where Frankenstein has this really odd dream in which he commits sort of incestuous necrophilia within the dream, and then he wakes up and then the creature is with him near to his bed. And some have argued that there is a sort of link between what is going on in the dream and what is going on in this connection with the creature who is so near his bedchamber. Unable to endure the aspect of the being I had created, I rushed out of the room, continued a long time traversing my bedchamber, unable to compose my mind to sleep. At length, lassitude succeeded to the tumult I had before endured, and I threw myself on the bed in my clothes, endeavouring to seek a few moments of forgetfulness. But it was in vain. I slept indeed, but I was disturbed by wildest dreams. I thought I saw Elizabeth, that's his wife, by the way. I thought I saw Elizabeth in the bloom of health, walking in the streets of Ingolstadt. Delighted and surprised, I embraced her, but as I imprinted the first kiss on her lips, they became livid with the hue of death. Her features appeared to change, and I thought that I held the corpse of my dead mother in my arms. A shroud enveloped her form, and I saw the grave worms crawling in the folds of the flannel. I started from my sleep with horror. A cold dew covered my forehead, my teeth chattered, and every limb became convulsed. When by the dim and yellow light of the moon, as it forced its way through the window shutters, I beheld the wretch, the miserable monster whom I had created. He held up the curtain of the bed, and his eyes, if eyes they may be called, were fixed on me. His jaws opened, and he muttered some inarticulate sounds, while a grin wrinkled his cheeks. He might have spoken, but I did not hear. One hand was stretched out, seemingly to detain me, but I escaped and rushed down the stairs. I took refuge in the courtyard belonging to the house which I inhabited, where I remained during the rest of the night, walking up and down in the greatest agitation, listening attentively. catching and fearing each sound as if it were to announce the approach of the demoniacal corpse to which I had so miserably given life. I read a little bit more than was necessary to make my point, but I thought it's good to hear a snippet of the original book and how wacky and grim it is. But you see my point. There are hints at a merging of traditional with non-traditional sexual connections in this that could be read into later versions, especially The Bride of Frankenstein. However, while it's fun to explore this stuff, I have my doubts as to whether that James Whale set out to make a film about homosexuality just because he was a homosexual himself. I think the relationship between the monster and the blind hermit is one of friendship primarily, and a connection between two outsiders. And in some ways, you could argue the reason why he calls the hermit friend and his potential bride friend is not because he sees both as sexual beings, but that he sees neither as sexual beings. That he hasn't developed this part of himself yet and is genuinely just looking for companionship. Now, maybe the creature did have sexual thoughts, and it would be interesting to explore how they might manifest themselves, but I think it's just... I guess you could watch Frankenhooker for that. But I think it's just as powerful to see the creature simply wanting a friend. You know, someone to be with him, even though society looks upon them as freaks. And actually, ironically, I think it's from this angle that the homosexual theme resonates the most for me. Now, I'm not gay myself, but I imagine if I were, it would be massively challenging and isolating to come to terms with it if you were not already surrounded by a fully supportive culture or that lifestyle. Certainly in the 1930s, it wasn't particularly like that. But even today, in our liberated modern society, it's still not easy at all for people to come out as homosexual. And besides, even behind the sexual nature of all of this discussion, there is still underneath all of this men and women seeking companionship with one another, or a friend, as it were, who will be with them and accept them for who they are. For the gay person, it might be a relationship with someone, even while the villagers outside are hammering on the door and burning torches, saying that the people inside are sick and warped and sinful. I think if I was gay, I would find the story of Frankenstein really rather touching, and in some ways quite painful, because it's about someone who society classes as different through no fault of their own, and they are written off by many, cut off from relationships with others. I think the isolation of that, perhaps an isolation that Whale felt himself, the unorthodox for the time, his sexuality, I think it's poignantly seen in the story of Frankenstein. That one can read homosexual themes into the story of Frankenstein is clear you can, and it can be rewarding to reflect on these themes. However, the question of whether the original filmmakers intended this, I think, is far more difficult to assess. While James Whale may well have subconsciously associated ideas from his personality to his filmmaking, but then who on earth wouldn't? Every filmmaker produces something informed by their very selves. It doesn't mean that The Bride of Frankenstein is some sort of gay tract or thesis. To do that, I think, would be to reduce this director to his sexuality, which is actually a bit patronizing when you think about it. I think it's helpful to read a quotation from David Lewis, who was a longtime boyfriend or partner to Whale. And he said this: "Jimmy was first and foremost an artist, and his films represent the work of an artist, not a gay artist, but an artist." I think that's really helpful. It's fantastic to read meanings into films and draw out cultural theories from them. Heck, that's the nature of this podcast, as you can probably tell. But I think you have to be very careful saying this must be what the original artist had in mind. We often have no idea. And so in some ways it doesn't really matter. That, after all, is the very nature of art and creativity. It can be interpreted. Films, like books and all culture, are living things that change and adapt to the audiences. I think that's the fun of it. So while I can't say what the original intentions were of Shelley or Whale or any other Frankenstein rendition, I can share how the Frankenstein story most resonates with me, and that is actually as a story that is about tragic rejection and heartbreaking loneliness that challenges the very idea of what is evil and what is good. But to find out what that's all about, tune in to the fourth and final episode in this little series on the Frankenstein story. And until then, don't forget the flicks the church forgot.
It's happened. It's moving. I can't believe it. Dr. Frankenstein has brought the monster to life. And I believe the world should beware.